Hello and welcome back to the How the Race Was Won podcast. I'm Dane Cash, and who are you on this call with me?
I'm Cosmo Catalano, bike racing analyst extraordinaire, I believe, is the title you have given me.
That is what I say. Yeah, that's the title that I gave you. Yeah, and it's true. You are an extraordinaire bike racing analyst, Cosmo Catalano. You're so extraordinaire, in fact, that before we even did this podcast, you already put up a video telling the world how the race was won, which is great because then I was able to watch that. Ooh. So I already know how the race was won. But I'm very excited to tell the people with you.
You have a 45-second window into knowing how the race was won. There's a lot of stuff that I want to put in there that doesn't make it in there.
Well, that's great. You should do a podcast. This is your opportunity.
There is an opportunity there.
We, of course, are going to talk about the Amstel Gold Race. It's a bike race in a place that has a lot of bikes. And for a very long time, it's been sponsored by a beer company. And maybe my favorite part of the day was the celebration with the beer at the very end of the race. Mm. But we're going to get you there by telling you how it was all won so that you have the context to understand what happened there at the end. Cosmo's also going to tell you why Brabantse Pale is underrated.
They're not even going to know what Brabantse Pale is. They're going to be like, what is that?
Well, you're going to tell them. It's going to be great. Yeah, those are the things we're going to cover today. We're going to talk about the guy who won the Amstel Gold Race. We're going to talk about the guy who finished second, but maybe could have won the Amstel Gold Race. We're going to talk about the guy who finished 22nd, mostly because he didn't win the Amstel Gold Race, and like he wins a lot of races lately.
It wasn't even that he didn't win. Like he wasn't there. He was a fleet in being, I guess, as old-timey, you know, World War I British sailing people would say. His shadow loomed large over the event,
but his person was
relatively unremarkable.
To find out who these people are, the winner, the runner-up, the guy who finished 22nd, you're going to have to listen to the rest of the show. But before we do any more telling you how the race was won, just real quick, if you're not a member already, you should head on over to escapecollective.com/join and become a member to support this podcast and also Placeholders and Wheel Talk. Geek Warning, Performance Process, we'd love to have you in our very cool crew of members. You support everything we do. Those of you who already are members, we're very grateful. All right, on with the show. Amstel Gold Race was Sunday. Earlier in the week, a little prelude to the rest of the show. Just quickly here, you know, it's not even a World Tour race. But Brabantse Pale, why is it underrated? Tell our dear listeners why they should have watched, what happened that made it worthy of their time.
Well, I mean, we should say it's a Wednesday bike race that is also known as Flèche Brabanconne. I think I am saying that correctly. Although its official name, as Flanders Classics event, is in Dutch, Brabantse Pale. It is a good, not overpoweringly hard race, like you see at Amstel or you see at Liège, or you see at, Liège works too, but it's between Roubaix and Amstel. It's shorter. There are fewer climbs, so the climbs are really good. They're really well spaced to make attacks happen. The Mosgestraat, the biggest climb in the race, is kind of unique in classics climbs in that it really starts not as hard as it could be and is hardest at the very top, which makes it a great launch pad for attacks and also for catching people who did not ride the hill correctly. It also becomes almost not quite Koppenberg unrideable when it gets wet, but it can be very slick. It's just a fun race. It's a really cool race to watch. Both the men's and women's races transpired in a way that was kind of outside the normal. Like there's a break, you catch the break, there's an attack. Like there was a lot of breakaway chicken, a lot of people trying to bridge over to a winning group instead of again, that catch and attack. It was just, it's a really well done race. The climbs are good. The scenery is distinctive. It kind of finishes with a not all that hard, but very curvy urban climb in Overijse. So you have poor lines of sight, but it's actually very fast. Like it's a big ring climb when people are riding it seriously. And so, yeah, it's a race not a lot of people know about. Once Roubaix is over, it's like, okay, no more cobbles. And it's like, no, there are cobbles. There are also cobbles and hills. It's going to be good. Trust me, watch this race. It doesn't get as much attention as it should.
And this year's winners?
Benoit Cosnefroy of Decathlon.
Nice.
He had a very Benoit Cosnefroy win where he ended up in a small group sprint and was faster than everybody. And the women's race was won by Eliza Longo-Borghini, who is just having a banger of a year.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Won by like 44, I'm looking right now, 41 seconds ahead of Demi Vollering.
Convincingly over Demi Vollering. Although Vollering had relatively limited reason to go as hard as she could once it was clear she wasn't going to get, she wasn't going to catch ELB, and the group behind her also wasn't going to catch her. So
another cool fact about Brabantse Pale, it's a race that Ruth Edwards has won.
Won over Demi Vollering.
And that was close, like really close.
Yep.
That was quite a day.
Shades of the install.
Yeah, a little preview of what exactly. We'll get into that in a bit. All right, Brabantse Pale, underrated. Hopefully Cosmo has sold you. Well done. Benoit Costefoy, well done, Elisa Longoborghini. Then we got to the Ardennes, which sort of technically doesn't actually happen until Wednesday because Amstel's not in the Ardennes for us, but whatever. Amstel Gold Race, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the men's race first. We're going to do a little bit on the women's race, and then you're going to get a lot more of that in Wheel Talk, where Abby and company will break things down. Men's race, what's the headline, Cosmo?
While the Vanderpoodle is away, the Pidcocker Spaniel will play.
Oh, that's... Yeah. I feel like... That's prepared. That's really, really well done.
Like that, you know, I was thinking, because there's always when the cat's away, when the dog's away, the cat will play. I don't know.
I get it. I'm very impressed.
I feel like that's a good summary of the race.
And to be clear, the Vanderpoodle was there. I mean, he was at the race. He just like wasn't there when it mattered. Tom Pidcock won.
Yes.
I think along with Strade Bianche, those are now his two biggest wins in his career.
I think this one was special for him after the last, he joked after the race that this was his second win, even though it's his first win, because maybe he beat Van Aert in 2021, and maybe
that was
a photo finish
to end all photo finishes.
A photo finish without the photo.
Yeah, it's kind of hard. We'll never know. It was called not for him. Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. He won this one, though, and it was close, but not so close as to be a photo finish. Tom Pidcock won. Mark Hirschi finished second. Tish Benoit was third. And Mr. Matthew Vanderpool, who got all the coverage, and even during the race when I thought it was pretty clear he was not coming back. Obviously, he has a history of doing insane things in this race. So I think some of the commentary team wanted to remind us of this fact. But I thought it was pretty clear he was not coming back, even with 10K to go, maybe. But we still got to hear about him a lot. Still got to see him on screen a lot. But he didn't win. And he has, been winning a lot lately. So I have no beef with Matthew Vanderpool. But as somebody who has had to analyze bike races the last 2 weeks and come up with ways that things were done tactically, which, to be fair to his team, they rode really well at Roubaix.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to be able to talk about something else, put it that way. I was thinking about this today, and I was wondering, if I'm complaining about this, imagine being like a tennis analyst after like 5 years at the French, and then like Nadal does it for another, 7 years? Anyway,
mm-hmm.
Vanderpool didn't win. How was this race won?
Trying to think of where I should even start. I'm going to go with the Quinten Hermans crash around 70K to go. At this point, you've got to do a lot of work to get back into the race.
Teammate
a break.
Matthew Vanderpool.
Yes, teammate of Matthew Vanderpool. We should say that, yes.
Yeah.
Matthew Vanderpool's teammate, Quinten Hermans, has a crash. He's got to chase back on. It takes him a long time to get there. You see Vanderpool, you see his team, but you don't see as many of them as maybe you're used to seeing. You're also noticing that the group is keeping breaks pretty close. There's lots of flyers, small groups going to keep going. Mikel Honoré, Louis Vervaca from EF and Soudal Quickstep, respectively, are in multiple moves. Finally, Michał Kwiatkowski, two-time winner from Ineos. He goes on an attack. MVP Matthew Vanderpool responds. Looks like something's going to happen. Mateo Jorgensen is right there. And then nothing. Nothing kind of happens. Like there's Alpecin's at the front. They're riding hard. Vanderpool is there. There's
still
no
a break
attack
at this point.
There's still a break at this point, but it's close, which is important. No attack happens, and Mark Hirschi from UAE is like, you know what? I'm getting out of here. I'm going up the road. I'm doing it. I don't care about Vanderpool. And after that happened, people kind of realized that this wasn't going to unfold to script. And you saw all sorts of moves kind of going up and down the road, including one with Tom Pidcock, where he attacked on a downhill, lots of twisty corners. And then kind of that was his pull, and he got to sit on the back of the group and get towed up. Thijs Benoot from Visma really didn't want to stick around, tried a lot very early to try and get the group smaller, wasn't successful. Then about, I think 13K was where Again, Mark Hershey made the attack that split the group down to four. There's kind of a fifth angler, but really it's just four, kind of even three, with Sudal's Mario van Sevenant, who was off the back, managed to catch back on a few times. Pidcock did a lot of work, but more keeping the group honest. He would try an attack on a descent.
Oh, yeah.
He would try attack on an uphill, but never, you know, he would put in enough work that people took it seriously, but it wasn't ever a do or die kind of move. And the group would kind of come back together. It was enough that he didn't really have to worry about the group feeling like he wasn't doing enough. And also that the group was maybe going to have to plan around him a little bit.
And chase even at some points. Yeah. Because there was somewhere he actually got gaps.
Yeah. No, he definitely got space, both downhill and uphill. But it was just enough that was like, you know, he was kind of cracking the whip a little bit. But EF at one point materialized on the front of the peloton. And the gap at this point is still only about 30 seconds. So it looked like it might be possible for them to bring back the group for a Marijn Vandenberg sprint. But then Vandenberg, I think 5K to go, ran into a fence as the field was coming around a corner. And that kind of took the wind out of that sails. So he had this group of four ahead, the remainder of the early break behind them, which was five at that point. And then he had a peloton that just wasn't going to come back. And eventually Van Sevenant is like, okay, well, I don't want to get caught and finish ninth because clearly I'm the weakest one here. So he leads out the sprint. Pidcock gets on his wheel. Hershey goes to Pidcock's wheel. And, you know, the sprint launches and Hershey looks faster, but just runs out of real estate. Pidcock has enough time to celebrate safely, I might add. And he takes the win.
All right, lots to talk about here. So first, I think it's fair to say that, I mean, in my opinion, Pidcock did so many things right today. And it was a race that was close enough that, you know, all these little things, any one of them could have made the difference. I felt like what you were talking about, the way that he was doing work in the group and all that stuff is very true. So
he really managed the group, you know? He wasn't just a passenger. He wasn't an engine. He really kind of like threw his weight around a little bit in the break.
And without wasting too much energy.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to give him his due. Well, I want to talk about him. But before we do that, before we break down that finish, which I think was, there's stuff to talk about there. Real quick, let's talk about the Matthew Vanderpoel in the room because he did win the previous two major races. This is home turf for him. It's the biggest race in the Netherlands, and he is a Dutch person. He has won the race before in spectacular fashion. One of the most memorable wins in my time.
Iconic.
Yeah. And I don't like to use that word, but because if you use it too much, it's pretty iconic.
If it works for anything, it works for that finish.
Yes. If you haven't seen Matthew Vanderpoel, if you've not watched the 2019 edition of this race, you happen to be a fan of this show and haven't watched it, I would definitely suggest go and find a video of that. It was pretty spectacular what he did there. And I think that was also in the mind of the commentators today watching as he missed or chose not to go or couldn't go. We'll never really know. Why didn't he win? I mean, he didn't go in with the moves that I think the literal answer is that he didn't go with the winning move. I'm wondering, did he choose not to go with the winning move? Because it looked like he was pretty strong. Like he was chasing down moves quite capably.
He was sitting on the front of the field when Hershey started the festivities.
And then it was as if he decided he didn't want to go. But then it seemed like to me there was a point at which I thought it was pretty clear that the move was gone. Like the winning move was gone. And he needed to get into it. And it just didn't seem like he wanted to.
I don't know that it was ever like foot down gone, right? Because the gap was always so small. And like there was still a lot of just chaos, right? People were moving back and forth between groups. People were attacking. People were coming back. So it wasn't going back to that 2019 finish. This was nothing that Vanderpoel hasn't been able to do before. And he just didn't do it and didn't seem interested in doing it. He was really just kind of there.
I do think the part of this, like, it's impossible to know how strong he was, how much he could have gone.
Yep.
Or like maybe he could have gone at first, but chose not to because he didn't think it was going to work. And then by the time he realized it was too late, I think it should be pointed out. In my opinion, I think this race does not suit him as well as a Flanders or Roubaix. He's a big guy. And there's a lot of short, steep climbs at Amstel. Obviously, not so many as to keep him from having won before. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of the body types, Pidcock, this race suits him really well.
Yep.
And I think for Vanderpoel, again, obviously he's good enough to win it. But I also think it's not perfect for him. And the repeated late, short, steep climbs, maybe there was a point where he was capable of chasing to get onto that group, but chose not to. And then by the time he realized it was too late. Well, I think we'll never know. I mean, it's impossible to say whether he could or couldn't have gone.
I think it feels like it's a low percentage shot, right? Like he could maybe try and do that. But if it's going to, you know, if for whatever reason he feels like it's not, might hurt his chances at Liège, it might, he might feel like he said at San Remo, like he was there on the Poggio, but he didn't feel good. Maybe today he just didn't feel good. At Flanders, he said he didn't feel that good. And at Roubaix, he was like, I felt great. And at Roubaix, he was just kind of like, woo. So it could just be, you know, he wasn't feeling great. His team definitely wasn't having a great day. We talked about Hermans having his crash.
Søren Krogh Andersen was also not as strong as I thought he would be on this terrain. I mean, to be fair, this is a team that, like, even today's performance from the team, not from Vanderpool himself, but like 2 years ago, I would have not expected even this. So I think they deserve credit.
Yeah. No, it just
weren't great.
Their track record this season has been very strong. Better. And so anything other than, you know, powerful dominating victory is a step down.
Yeah. All right. Vanderpool didn't win. And I think, that's all we need to say. Pidcock, he did so many things right. I liked the way you talked about his group management. I felt like if you're in a group like that, a small group where it's small enough that you're not going to have obvious hangers-on, you really don't want to sit at the front of that group for a long time. You either want to try to avoid working if you can, which is hard in a small group, or go hard and force others to work hard, which is what I think Pidcock did. Both of those things. So like you were saying, when he was going, it was keeping the group honest. And then he was finding ways to not wear himself out. So he kept it hard, which I think really suits him because he's a good climber. I don't know how much he would have trusted his sprint. I think he wanted to make it hard. And I think he did a good job of that without wasting too much energy.
Yeah, and I think this it's more than just the climbs. Like, this is a very twisty course with a lot of road furniture where there are descents that you can kind of milk. Like, if you hit a corner right, you can save yourself 10 pedal strokes over a guy who doesn't. And I think that he's just very precise with the bike. It's one of the reasons why he's not good at riding sand in cyclocross. But I think it plays really well into his favor at a race like Amstel. And I think I saw him use that a couple of times. He was really confident riding. It almost feels like he made the race he needed it to be for him to win.
Yeah.
And I will talk about Hershey too, because I think he did the same thing. I think just
totally
didn't quite work out for him.
Rode really well. And
But I think Ineos did a ton of work early, kind of helping, because they had a lot of guys on the front at some point. And then you saw that kind of Kwiatkowski softening attack. And then they made themselves scarce until the moment where Pidcock went. And I think a lot of that is guys probably down in the group, making sure Pidcock has all the support he needs, making sure he can get up. If he has to go up the outside, there's somebody in front of him in an Ineos kit, you know, pushing the wind out of the way. And again, having that gap small to the breakaways was really critical. Having those bodies on the road where you could sort of hop your way across versus having a big bridge effort where no matter how smart and clever you are on the descents, like, you still got to rotate through and pedal on hard ground.
And that was definitely the case in the final, I don't know, 30K, where there's all these little groups all over the road. And if you wanted to get from like way back to the front, you did have the ability to kind of go from one to the other, to the other, to the other, and have those slipstreams that you're kind of sneaking through.
Although I think also when you say from the way back, you mean like from the peloton. And it's important to know that the peloton was shoulder to shoulder at this, like, why isn't Vanderpool attacking period. So if you weren't well positioned there, you really didn't have the option to get up and get into this party that was going on at the front of the field. I mean, you did, but it's going to be a lot of work, a lot of elbowing, maybe you ride over the grass. Whereas, you know, Pidcock was where he needed to be and was pretty judicious in when he chose to go across.
Yeah. And once he did, and like you said, I mean, you had Hershey there. Benoit really didn't want it to be a big group.
Benoit was doing the work.
Yeah. And also he stands out because he's in a bright yellow kit. And he's big compared to these other guys. Like, Pidcock is not a large man. Yeah. I feel like Benoit, he definitely looked like you could see everything he was doing because he was very obvious. But yeah, the last, you know, 30K was kind of constant. I think it would probably be a hard job to have, like, written on the graphic which groups were which, because there were several at any given point. And the climbs are so, like, they're stacked up so close with each other. Mm-hmm. It's not like one climb, 5K, another climb. It's like 2K, 3K. I mean, they're like one after another, and they're all these short, steep climbs. And so that makes it really hard to control. And I think it's a great reason to put on an attack when they did. And they kind of did what we've been saying people should do, which is attack before Vanderpool does.
Well, I did they attack before or did they attack because he didn't, right?
Yeah, right. So maybe, I feel like maybe he was never going to.
I got the sense that everybody was waiting for the Vanderpool attack and they were going to try and hold his wheel. And if he was invincible again, they would, you know, figure out their battle for the lower places on the podium. And I think the teams that realized the fastest that that wasn't going to be what happened today were the ones that came out on top.
The UAE and the Ineos club.
Yep. I feel kind of bad for EF because they were up in the front of the race, like making things happen with people up the road. And they just did not see him until the like fading moment, the 11th hour, to have a plan. And then the plan actually looked pretty good because there was always the chance that everything was going to come back. And, you know, Vandenberg has been sprinting really good.
Yeah, he has been great. Yeah. Let's talk about the finishing straight where, you know, Pidcock doing everything right extended to the final, I don't know, 100 meters, and Hirschi doing everything right didn't. Because I think there is an argument to be made that maybe Hirschi missed a trick. Is that the right use of this saying? I think it is.
It's bridge, right?
That makes sense, but I'm looking it up, and like nobody seems to know which of the various trick-taking games the phrase comes from. Anyway, sorry, I wish I could have been able to answer that question. What did Mark Hirschi not do? Was he going to be able, do you think, to have gotten this win?
Yeah, I honestly, you know, I think he had as good a shot as anybody. I think he had to be a little more aggressive than Pidcock.
He was kind of waiting for Pidcock.
No. I was just saying, like, throughout the whole course of the day, he seemed to be a little bit more aggressive.
Oh,
and then
gotcha.
in the finale, yes, he definitely seemed to be waiting for Pidcock's wheel.
Yeah.
And there's it's so hard to tell because of how the camera's cut that whether or not Hirschi was trying to stay on Pidcock's wheel or trying to get around him along the barriers. And this may have been intentional on Pidcock's part. He may have like sort of left, you know, not the door open, but like the window on the door open, kind of almost daring Hirschi to try and shoot through it and then moved over. It really looks like Hirschi had to back off for a pedal stroke or two to let Pidcock start his sprint at a point where it was highly unlikely there would be enough pavement between that moment and the finish line for him to go past Pidcock and win the race. I think he was clearly faster in the closing meters, but I think Pidcock was just set up a little bit better and maybe, you know, got the better of Hirschi kind of in that position battle behind Van Sevenen.
And I think it's an example of using, again, who knows if this was intentional, right? Like this could have just been, he was positioned correctly. It worked out this way, but nothing about that sprint was like untoward. There's no reason that it's something that is bad. And yet he did play the positioning game right. So we've talked about this a couple times before. And I think this is an example of you can play the positioning game correctly without it being sketchy. Because I do think, yeah, I mean, Hirschi's closing speed looked to me clearly faster as well. That said, finishing second for Mark Hirschi at this race is a good result for him lately. I mean, there's kind of been a lot of where has he been sentiment about Mark Hirschi.
I think literally those words were said, maybe even with an F-bomb on a previous edition of this podcast.
And
but not by one of us.
Yes, that is true. Kaylee Fretz was pondering this question. And I think maybe Mark listened and he said, well, hey, I was second at Amstel. That's my answer. Not first, though. Maybe if he had been better positioned, maybe if he'd gone a little earlier. I think it's really great to be right behind the guy who opens up the sprint. And then Hirschi's an example of why it can be a little bit less great to be in the third spot. Because then your bike leg to back and you got to get around people. Yeah.
The way I kind of sum it up is he made the selections happen. He was the determinant for a lot of the major breaks in the action. But Pidcock was sort of the one who determined how the race would play out. Like with that group management and then having the better setup on the sprint.
In both cases, for both riders, as a bike racing analyst, I am grateful for the way they rode because they did make it an interesting race. It was fun. It's something we have plenty to talk about. There's tactics and it was not a race that Matthew Vanderpool attacked from 1,000 kilometers out. So thank you, Tom Pidcock and Mark Hirschi, for being aggressive and doing what you did and making this a good race. Let's take a quick break. All right, let's give people the headline from a pretty wacky women's race. I mean, maybe there's two headlines, right? Because like,
yeah,
Neutralization Plus.
I'm still not 1,000% clear on the details, but it seemed like the women started one race and then raced a completely different race after the neutralization. Like, didn't they change the course so it was just like three laps of a non-neutralized section of road?
Abby Mickey made the point that it did seem like the way that they handled it seemed to have been done mostly to sort of ensure that there wouldn't be any conflict with the men's race, which could have been resolved by putting more time between the two. So, yeah, maybe that's something they can avoid doing in the future. So there was a neutralization. That's one of the headlines. The other headline being...
fastest sprinter loses race.
Yeah.
Not on purpose, but it looked that way.
A little bit of an early celebration by Lorena Vivas, which she's young and she's fast. And most of the time she's not going to lose when she starts to celebrate really close to the line. But most of the time isn't all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I have particular sympathy just because of the situation surrounding this sprint. She had gone through a gap that was very tiny between Elisa Longo Borghini and the barriers that probably would have made Nils Paulet run home in tears. But she got through that, and everything to the not barrier side of it, she was blasting past and would have been really easy to not realize that someone else had come through that tiny little gap behind her and was closing on the finish line.
A former winner of the race, also a three-time world champion and
pretty good bike racer.
That's just on the road. Marianne Vos is the winner, and another win in what's been a really good season for her. En Loop, Dwars, this... yeah, I mean, this is from the rider who like was already the greatest women's roadie ever and also cyclocross star like years ago and just still doing it. Pretty awesome from her.
Many of these women's races did not exist when she started racing bikes.
I mean, it's like that's really true. So yeah. True.
Literally true.
What anything big stand out to you like worth kind of pointing out? We're going to, like I said, Wheel Talk's going to dive into the specifics, but...
I just enjoyed how incredibly frustrated Eva von Echt seemed to be with her breakaway companions. And she managed to be mad at them for like 30K and then lead out the sprint, which is a hard day's work in my book.
Oh, yeah. I wonder if it will, like, will that pay dividends in the future? You know, like if you're in a breakaway with her, maybe now you know that she'll get mad at you.
I can't for the life of me. I mean, yeah, there wasn't a lot of contribution from Yara Castellan in particular, but like, you know, that's bike racing. Castellan was still like 10th, I think, in the end or in the top 10. So like, clearly it wasn't that she couldn't keep up. It was that she was, you know, doing bike racing things.
But also, Van Echt's team won. So
yes, they did.
Kind of worked out in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. For more on the Amstel Gold women's race, check out Wheel Talk. Abby and company will break that down, I think, something like 24 hours after this show goes up. All right. What is coming up? It's the Ardennes.
The actual Ardennes.
The actual. They're going to the region that is called the Ardennes.
The race is so closely associated in the mind of the organizer that they don't have separate Instagram accounts. They're just at Ardennes Classics or Classics Ardennes. Yeah, it doesn't...
I didn't realize that.
It's very weird. I know, but yeah. Flesh Malone on Wednesday and Liège-Bastogne-Liège on Sunday.
Should we do the music again this year?
Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
I would love to. Can we... let's make it a thing.
My voice is a little...
That was really good, actually. Cosmo, for the listeners who don't know, I mean, he told me before the show he's not feeling very well, and I thought that was... lovely baritone.
No, thank you.
Flesh Below. It's the one where they traditionally they like do a lead out all day for the bottom of the Mur de Huy. They constantly make little tweaks to the route to potentially maybe sort of kind of try to avoid it. It doesn't usually work. This year they cut out the finale still does end with the Mur de Huy, of course, because it's an awesome hard winding climb. But the past couple of years they have gone up the Côte de Chirave right beforehand. And now that's not going to happen. So there's a little bit of downtime after the Côte de Ref. And maybe that will change the way that this race is raced. I guess we'll find out. The people who are going to be at this race will be the ones who decide this. Yeah, the guy who won last year won Tadej Pogacar. Unclear whether he's racing. As of press time, we don't know yet. So I wish I could tell you more about the full start list, but it's not quite confirmed yet. That's the perils of recording this far out. We do know he's planning to race Liège, which is the monumental one, one of the oldest bike races in the world. That's on Sunday. That's the one where they go from Liège to Bastogne to Liège, and that's actually what they do now. There was a period where they didn't quite do that. That is the race that hopefully, again, maybe by the time this podcast goes up, we will know differently, and then I'll feel silly, but we're hoping to see a Vanderpool Pogacar showdown there.
I'm going to see them break away together at 80K to go.
Oh, man. That would be kind of boring, but like it might happen. And for a long time, this race, especially like in the Valverde, in the height of the Valverde years, it was like wait around until the finale.
It wasn't just this race. It was Flesh Wallonne and it was Amstel. They all ended at the top of roughly similar hills. They're very different hills, but it's a steep paved climb that's relatively.
Yeah. The metrics are similar.
Yeah, it's not, the person who can pedal up the hill the fastest was the same kind of year on year on year. And they've done a good job breaking that up.
So. Yeah. Yeah, so take that, those of you who defame the good name of this race, including the same person we mentioned previously as having been on this podcast, who whenever I put Liège-Bastogne-Liège-related categories into the Escape Collective bike grid game, which if you haven't played, you should. I always get messages from Kaylee Fretz. He says that I shouldn't put those categories in, which makes me just want to like put only Liège in this week. I mean, if you're ever going to do it, right?
I do kind of like the Ons finish. I miss it a little.
I didn't mind it. I like the simplicity, of going from Liège to Bastogne to Liège. Yeah. Anyway, that's on Sunday. That is hopefully, as we've said, our chance to see a Vanderpool showdown. It is a monument. It's the fourth of the year. It's the last of the big spring classics. There's another monument at the end of the year, but this is the last one in the spring. And Pogacar has won it before. We're going to get to see him in a final major race before he decides to head on down to Italy, because Grand Tour season is coming up pretty soon. So much to look forward to. And we will have all of the bike racing analysis in another week as well. So check back with us then. We'll tell you how that race was won. For now, I'm Dane Cash, and who are you? What was this?
I'm Cosmo Catalano. That was the How the Race Was Won podcast.